So we'll vamp a little bit more and buy us have some time.
Okay. What do we want to talk about?
I don't know. I don't know. I feel like I don't want to get too far into something and then he pops up and then we have
Oh
to
no,
stop.
let's do it. Let's go too far into something. Like
Let's go too far into something.
Oh.
I can go. All right, I'll share something that
Yeah.
I am struggling with. I think I have acid reflux out of nowhere. I think I got
Oh,
acid reflux, like kind of out of left field, and I'm
really?
trying to navigate that.
This is because of all the Philly cheesesteaks.
I don't think so. I wish, I don't know. Oh, here comes our guest. Just then, just as soon as I start to talk about
As soon
acid
as you
reflux,
started to be
I see
physically
this is what's
vulnerable
going to
about
be
your
real.
health.
I was about to, in a desperate plea for help, it gets cut. Right. Shh. Keep that to yourself.
Insert ad about reflux medicine or something.
Exactly.
We're actually just
Exactly.
trying to get more sponsors for
That's right. That's right.
the
I would love that. I would love if we have fake sponsors. We should just start pretending like we have sponsors.
Yeah, I was in the Google Meet. I don't know. This is
Oh,
a new
geez.
Oh yeah,
Oh, there you go. My
this is
bad.
open.
I was literally about to say, I was about to say to Richard,
Yeah.
I hate when people when Google puts a Google Meet in there and some people go there by mistake and they like as sure as shit that's what happened. Like I was certain that that wasn't in there and I guess it was. So I my apologies. That's on
Yeah,
us, the
my fantastical just is like, hey, join your Google Meet. And I just click the button. I don't even go back to the invite. But how,
I mean,
anyway.
I'm glad Google could be so
You're
helpful
welcome.
like that.
Yeah, it's great to see both of you. It's been so too long, too long. It's
Look at
been a
you.
long time. Yeah, are you in a cabin by choice? Is this where is this?
Look at him.
Yeah, this I am in a cabin by choice. This is our place in Tahoe, and that I increasingly spend more time at now that I get retired. I don't know, retired. I don't know. It sounds weird to say that, but I'm not working right now, and so I can spend a lot of time up
Good for
here.
you.
And it's in the middle of a U.S. forest. It's this weird, very cool place, off grid, in the Sierras. We're at 7,200 feet here, and so I can go snowmobiling right out my front door. I can go backcountry skiing 5 minutes away.
Oh my God.
It's this really amazing little spot that we have here.
Excellent.
That
So this is
altitude is
actually a
insane.
perfect transition from what we were talking about, because we were talking to Craig Bryans about retiring frequently. How did he put it, Joe? It was
He
like
said
what
retiring a little bit
forward.
at a time.
Yeah, a little bit at a time, where you
Yeah.
never quite disconnect, but you're always taking time off to do the things you would have done in your retirement, and then kind of circling back in this kind of healthier version of retirement versus the retire and then die 6 years later because you're bored stiff.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I mean, for me it was I don't know about you, and I know that this is a very privileged thing to say, and most people when I say it will be like, yeah, of course, that's the way life works. But I graduated university in May of 1995. I started work immediately, and I've literally never stopped working until last April. So it's about 30 years. When we closed down Teen and Lax, we closed it on January 31st, which is a Friday, 2015. I showed up for work at Meta on Monday. So
Really?
like I yep, I like
So
Friday we
the
closed the
weekend
business
was your
down at,
retirement.
yeah, literally. And then got like went out with all the went out with all the staff, team, people who worked at the company Friday night. Saturday went out with my friends. Sorry, Sunday, my family. Monday got on a plane. I was at work on Tuesday. So that's how that played out.
Well,
So yeah.
at least you wound up in a really chill, non-competitive part of Meta where the stakes
Yes.
weren't really high
It
and you
was
weren't working on really important. At least you wound up there.
I'm so glad you said that, Joe. I don't know if you remember history, but it was a relatively quiet time at Meta. Facebook then, circa 2016, not a lot going on. It was very chill. It was super chill.
So I think that's by way of an introduction that would
Oh,
be a good way
are
of
we
describing.
rolling?
We'll use all this. We'll use every part of the buffalo here on this podcast.
Damn it.
There's nothing that winds up on the cutting room floor.
I didn't realize.
No. So just to zoom out a minute, just to kind of give everybody a chance to catch up.
Because that was a fairly jarring cold open. Like that was like I just kind of dumped a lot of stuff down.
Yeah, that's fine.
This is how we roll. We roll.
Before you joined, I was talking about acid reflux. So you were a beautiful change of pace. We appreciate you. You're elevating the conversation. Well,
we can loop back to that later. Like, let's just put a pin in that one and we can come back to it.
I would appreciate that for my own like health and health. I need that kind of advice from, you know, I feel like I'm here with my cohorts. I feel like, you know, this is the group to talk about this with because.
Well, also, be honest, we're also looking for sponsors and we think that Prilosec would be a good, you know.
We're fishing for sponsors.
I understand. Yeah.
So John, if you wouldn't mind, just really briefly for the folks that haven't had a chance to meet you, Could you just introduce yourself and your background and like the you know, the Gantt chart kind of view of the whole thing?
Do people go like most recent backwards or like start at college? Like what's kind of chronological?
Nobody cares. Order? They just want to know you. Yeah. You can do it up and down. You could do like a 360.
All right. So I'll sort of start most recent and then kind of work back from there. Because I think as we get further back in time, it becomes less relevant. So most recently, I was at Meta and I spent, I was at Meta from 2015 through till last April, so 2023. A little over 8 years there. Mm-hmm. 5 of those years were spent running the AR/VR group, which is called Facebook Reality Labs, and you'll see that in the press, running design for that. And that was everything from the VR headsets to what you now see are the Meta Ray-Ban glasses, to a whole bunch of stuff that has not yet sort of seen the light of day. Super interesting hardware, software. I had industrial design. I had software. That was super interesting. I can talk more about that at some point. Prior to that, when I first got to Facebook, I worked on basically everything that wasn't newsfeed or ads. So that would be things like Facebook pages. Facebook Marketplace was something that literally my team developed from nothing when I was there. The developer network, Facebook login, what else did we work on? Search, a whole bunch of stuff, not specifically newsfeed, but like things that kind of are adjacent to newsfeed inside the Blue product. Prior to that, from 2002 until 2015, I ran a product design firm, or I co-founded and ran a product design firm called TN and Lax, which if you're old enough, you'll remember. And we were based out of Toronto, Canada. And so I was born and raised in Toronto, my whole life there, started to build a business in 2002. We managed to, I think, do pretty good stuff, met these two gentlemen. God, what year was the first owner camp? I was trying to think of that.
I think it was like 2012. I want to say it was around 2012 or 2013 at the latest.
I think I got my invitation in 2011. So it was probably, true.
So you know, that was kind of right in the thick of TN and Lax. Met Joe and Richard at Owner Camp in Arizona. And that was an amazing experience and one I really cherish. Prior to TN and Lax, I had worked I'll end my CV here. I had worked for a company called Modem Media, which was sort of a web, one of the sort of bigger original OG digital agencies, pure digital agency, didn't do any print TV. They were the ones who created
interactive agency, right?
Yeah, interactive agency. I mean, they're a good bit. I mean, they have a lot of claims to fame, but their big one was they created the first banner ad, the AT&T banner ad that ran on Hotwired, came out of Modem because AT&T was a client of theirs, and so they were a real pioneer. And I was the creative director of the Toronto office from roughly 1997 till 2002 before I started TN and Lax. So that's the quick history, but we can dive in anywhere you want.
Thank you, that's awesome, and I appreciate your sentiment around meeting everybody in Arizona. You were one of our favorite people to meet and all of that. I was just thinking about this about you, John, that one of the seminal moments I think of early owner camps, and we've talked about this a million times, I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but was this really robust conversation about time tracking, of all things, of all things to get into the weeds about. There was this kind of like epic, you know, like dialogue around time tracking. And it reminded me, one thing that you and I share is our passion for the movie The Firm, which is amazing. Which is a movie kind of about time tracking. When you really get into it.
Billable hours. Yeah. It is literally a, it is like Sex and the City, New York is the sixth character in The Firm. Billable hours is after Wilford Brimley and Tom Cruise is
the, down the list.
Gene Hackman, you know, and then time billable hours is the next
Who's character. The antagonist? I think billable hours are the antagonist. I think when you balls it all up, like, I think they're the antagonist. But yes, I think that like your perspective coming out of TN and Lax was really like welcome in those kind of owner conversations, because I think that there were, that was like a critical turning point for a lot of consulting teams to go, to be more intentional about the like leadership that they had, that they get to call their own shots, they get to do the work they want to do it. They get to kind of like plot their own course. Mm-hmm. There was right around that time was when the tide of the industry was kind of changing, and it wasn't the early days where demand far exceeded supply and leads just showed up and everybody, like things were starting to get, you know, more mature at that point, and you had to fight harder to be special. And I think that, you know, in those early conversations, there were teams like TN and Lax, there were teams in those conversations that really were standard bearers for like trying to do things their way and not become, you know, the favorite vendor, not become the favorite pet agency. And I remember just you sharing more in your thinking around how you sold things at that time, you know, the kind of the friction you would put into that process. Do you remember, like, was that always something that was intentional from the beginning of TN Lax? Or was that something that you and the team kind of woke up to as the industry matured and you had to like defend your corner?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we didn't start that way. Like we started like everyone else. We had a, like we had a rate card, you know, and like hours and like estimation was like how many hours, and you just do the math on that. I think, but when we started, so I talked about this company Modem Media, which was very much, you know, what I saw happening with those interactive firms was they just literally took what ad agencies did and they just sort of hit command copy, you know, command paste. And then they just changed like, oh, now there's like an engineering, you know, team, but there's like, you know, an eng director, a senior eng, you know, manager, like, like the, just this, these rate cards with like 42 layers of rates, right? And I was like, this is insane. And so when we started, like our great innovation was there's only two rates. There's partners and associates. That's it. Like that was like our big simplification. Okay. But we were still effectively doing.
Oh, you were a law firm. You're copying the firm.
We're totally. I'm raised by two lawyers, but both my parents are lawyers. So like I just copied their business models, you know, in ours. But even then we didn't do time tracking. I hated time tracking. Time tracking was like, like literally I'd rather be attacked by a shark than like fill out a time sheet. Like it's the worst, most souls. Cause you just make it up, right? You just like, you like Friday, shit, my time sheet's due. And you just like, you make it up. And I hated it. So even though we had a kind of clients would see a rate card, we did estimation kind of based on time. We weren't providing clients with like reports or anything like that. And for like the most part, they never asked. And when they would ask, I would like say, or if they did ask, I'd be like, well, I can make one up for you. Cause that's what you're getting from everyone else. Like if you really want me to, they would kind of chuckle and then would go away. But in around 2000, I won't necessarily get this year right. 2008, what I could see in the business, and I think anyone who's run a consulting agency business, you start to see, you look at your economics, right? And you see that as long as you're billing by the hour, the only way to grow is to increase your rates. And there's some market limit to how much you can increase your rates. And but just really quickly, what we were seeing in the legal profession at the time is they had hit, like, you know, they were charging like $3,000 an hour and clients were going like,
next rate.
They were doing like, no, like, and like there were large firms going out of business because they just, they couldn't raise their hourlies anymore. Or the other thing
they found
was,
a ceiling.
They found a ceiling. The market just wouldn't bear it. But like the cost kept going up. The other alternative is you just keep hiring people and now you have to keep those people busy. And that was unappealing to me as well, because I didn't really want to at the time run a 400 person. I was watching other agencies do this, like Huge was like a one I could just see. They were just like trying to grow as big as possible.
You also got to feed all those people.
The burn gets hot. You know, like every month there's a nut that you need to come up with to keep those people busy. I could see like fundamental problems in the business. And I started saying there's got to be a better way. Mm. And I found actually a guy named Ronald Baker, who's an accountant, who has written books mainly for accountants on how to get off time-based billing and move to value-based. And I found this little community of people, value-based pricing people. And I started to go deep into that. And we worked with a guy named Tim Williams, who a great consultant. I don't know if you guys have met him, but really good. And he kind of taught us. We kind of taught us like how to do value-based pricing. And we just, that was around 2008-ish, I want to say. Maybe we got rid of the hourly rates. We just got rid of them. And we started focusing on value. And we started talking to clients about what they're trying to accomplish, what it would be worth to them. Like, hey, if you're trying to do this thing, what would that be? If we were able to do that for you, what would that be worth to you? And like started to price the client, started to price the value of the work, and get more focused internally on the outcome that we were delivering versus the like output, you know? And I never liked the mismatch of incentives. Hourly-based, you know, compensation has terrible incentives, right? Because like even the most well-intentioned agency or, you know, service provider, that's still their incentive to like do as many hours as possible. And the client is like trying to do the opposite. It's terrible.
The market we've said on this podcast that it's tantamount to fraud, right? Because you're creating incentives to fuck each other. Like you're basically trying to fuck each other.
Right.
Yeah. Well, like your incentives are completely misaligned. And like, you know, clients always talk about like, oh, we want a partner. But it's like, okay, you want to share some risk then? Because that's what partners do. Let's talk about that. So I think that's like language that, or even agencies, like we want to be your partner, but you don't really, if you're time-based billing, that's not a partnership.
Yeah. So in those ways, you started to make that pivot into this kind of thinking. Were those initial conversations painful? Like as you're starting to like experiment with this with clients, was it frustrating? I mean, clients are still inexperienced at buying the kind of consultancy Tien and Lax did then today. So like, go back to that point, they were even less experienced. Like, how hard was it or what was the dynamic when you tried to like have these conversations?
So, I mean, you all probably went through this too, right? We were doing this like ungodly hybrid of fixed bid plus time-based, right? So like we would come up with the fixed bid by like estimating the hours and then you'd like fix the bid. And I was just like, well, look, we can just talk about like your budget is $300,000. What can we do for that? And so it wasn't that painful a conversation.
Okay.
Because we were like, hey, we're fixed bidding this. What the fuck do you care what the hourlies are? Like, if I can do this work for you for this amount of money, and that is more in line with a value-based like mindset, I would say. And so it wasn't that difficult. Where it got difficult is, you know, in those like RFP processes that like are run by some entity and they want you to list your rate card. And I actually got like perverse pleasure writing those sections that would be like, we don't have a rate card. We don't and like kind of taking this like maybe a little morally superior in retrospect, but like,
you had your Tyler Durden moments. It's fine.
Like preaching the gospel, you know, like in these responses. And quite frankly, it worked more times for us because it made us stand out. Right? Like it made us admit and be like, oh, this is interesting. Like these guys aren't like the others.
Right. Yeah, because it's less about the specific money issue and it's about, oh, they have an opinion. and they're willing to stand by that opinion.
Right.
We like that because currently we have an entire building full of cubicles of people who have no opinions. Right. These guys look interesting.
Right.
It worked out more than it didn't. I also used it a bit of a self-select, like it helped me winnow down clients.
Sure. Right?
Because like if someone's like, yeah, no, you don't check this box, I'm like, I will hate working with you. Like if this is how we are beginning, this is not going to end well.
There's no stakes here. We're both on our best behavior. It can be our best selves. And it already sucks.
That's like a first date. And you're like, listen, I love fart jokes. And they're like, no, that's not going to work for me.
No.
You need a red flag, right? You need something.
Check. Yeah. So I think that just, Joe, going back to something you said, and by the way, I just want to quote, say the Tracy Halverson episode, stop this one, whatever you're listening to, go listen to that one. That was amazing. Because she kills it in that. But
she's awesome.
And then as I was listening to it, I wanted to interject this point, not to interrupt her, but to be like, oh yeah, no, this is so important. She was talking about how, have you done this before as an important sort of marker in the conversation.
This is when you're talking to the client, right? The client.
Yeah. And she said something to the effect of hey, I wonder, have you ever done this before? Do you know what it's like to work with an agency? Like that's a really important qualifier. And I 100% agree with her. The language we would use is that there were two types of clients in the world. There were sophisticated clients and unsophisticated clients. A sophisticated client, like Ev Williams, medium, right? Guy knows how to build digital products, knows what he wants, really sophisticated. You don't need to client manage him. You're just there to really just work with him and help enable the thing he wants to create, right?
Yeah.
Unsophisticated clients, Joe, to your point before, are the ones who maybe have never done this before or done it with, maybe not the best, people or whatever. They're just not as sophisticated. And what we learned is unsophisticated clients require an insane amount of handholding.
Right.
And we didn't have an account services sort of, we didn't have account people. We just didn't kind of do that. And so unsophisticated clients were a nightmare for us because we just weren't built to service them. And so we got really good at seeking out sophisticated clients.
Right.
And those partnerships worked just much better for Tien and Lax as it was constructed. Now it limited our market, but we were happier. We felt we did better work. It was a better fit for us.
Right. Had you instead followed the pattern of Moda Media and just copy pasted the agency model, those unsophisticated clients might have been more palatable. Like you might have survived them better because you had an account layer and this layer and but this was just like a survival skill, was knowing these kinds of clients are going to bleed us dry if we work with unsophisticated, because we don't have the infrastructure to kind of educate them and handhold them and nurture them and all that kind of stuff. We're here to get work done. We're built to get work done.
Yeah. There were only two types of clients we would just out of hand refuse to work with at TNLX: government and pharma. Not because there's any moral issue or anything like that. They're just, government requires just an insane amount of bureaucracy to match their bureaucracy. Pharma is just too heavily regulated and is specialized. Right. And I wasn't that interested in pushing drugs. Maybe a bit of an ethical issue there, but we're just not built to serve this type of client,
One of the things that I think Tien and Lax was really famous for publicly, I think this, what you're describing, was stuff that was really novel to understand, talking to you directly and understanding kind of how the sausage was made from the inside. I don't know how broadcasted this was, but one of the things that I think at the same time that was really public about Tien and Lax that was really powerful was you guys spent a lot of time investing in these iPhone design template tools that Tien and Lax would just make available, and people lived and died by these things. I mean, I think it's hard to stress to somebody that wasn't a working designer at that time, how valuable, how crucial, how exciting those things were for a lot of designers in the community at the time. Am I right in that, that roughly started around the same time that you're describing, around that kind of same time period? And if, was it related in some way, or is this coincidental that that became something you did more for you know, community purposes or marketing purposes.
It was a bit
laid off, right?
So it was right after the, I want to say it was definitely 2000, probably eight or not, probably nine, 2009. Okay. I'd have to go back and look exactly. I know we were still, so if, with Teen and Lax, I can only place myself based on what office we were in, right? So like I knew yeah, that like, right. Like, yeah. Like the office, Richard, you, the office that you visited us at was like 2010. We only got that in 2010. So like everything's like either in one of three offices. Right. Yeah, right? So
there was a baseball conference room in the middle.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that was, so that was, this was before that. So it was pre 2010. Okay. iPhone comes out in 2007, eight, something like that.
Yeah.
And so it was, I think it was 2008, 2009, we did it. So here's, here's the reason we did it. We saw the iPhone and we wanted to figure out how to build iPhone apps. And this is like pre App Store. This is just like, this is just like we want, but we didn't know Xcode. We didn't know Objective-C, right? We knew how to design. And so I said, well, why don't we create like for ourselves a sticker sheet of the iOS components so that we can like start to quickly like mock stuff up, right? In Photoshop. And Jeff literally went into Xcode and like found every like individual asset, recreated it pixel, like, so it would be pixel perfect inside of Photoshop. Okay. And then we had the sticker sheet and I was like, hey, well, let's just put this on the site. And, you know, it was like, we didn't, it wasn't as calculated as like, oh, this is going to, you know, this is going to blow up. It got on the front page of Dig. Once again, aging ourselves, which, for those who are too young to remember, was like Reddit. Like it was like the front page of Reddit before Reddit existed. And it just blew up. And it did become this incredible marketing tool. And but that wasn't its sort of initial, its initial attention. Because we wanted to like, we wanted clients to come to us for to like help them design their iPhone apps. We hadn't done any. Here was a way to kind of like do that. But that was, I think, second or third on the list. And then it just kind of took a life of its own. And quite frankly, Apple internally used it until we stopped producing it. They now make their own. But literally, Apple doesn't have, believe it or not, doesn't actually have design tooling internally. Not in the way actually that like other companies do. And so we were basically doing their design tool unknowingly.
That's wild.
But another cool story, just last cool story about the PSEs. I have heard now over the years, how many founders come to me and say, I used your PSD for my pitch deck to mock up my idea to get my funding. And two that I know of that are, you know, big, Uber.
Holy Garrett, shit.
Garrett's first, he's like, that was your PSD that I used to create the first deck for Uber.
Jesus Christ.
And I'm Mike McHugh at Flipboard was another one. And those are two that I remember. There have been others over the time. I just don't off the top of my head recall them.
Of course they rewarded you, right? They sent you like a big
naturally.
Yeah, big.
No,
big,
I would assume you get residuals, right? Yes. No, of course.
No.
I got
the karma. Free ride, yeah, no, free ride. No, I got a very nice thank you in person, but no stock. Yeah, no,
So then you have this, not to like, I say this and I don't mean to like turn your life into Cliff Notes chapters or anything, but you know, you had this TN and Lax epic run, and then you wind up being acquired by Meta and wind up in Meta, and then you wind up in their VR team 2 years later. Like, I mean, I can't even imagine what that ride must have been like as you went from like different phases of Facebook into Meta into the emerging.
And you're also moving, right? You're moving from Toronto to
also
San Francisco, right?
To the US. A big move for sure. It was a bit of a, so when we had the opportunity
before we go there, John, maybe you can explain how Because I think a lot of us, I mean, we had just visited your offices. We had, I'd interviewed you for the design leadership book.
Yep.
And then literally like 2 months later, you're like, no, we're going to do this other thing. We're going to sell. Like you had gone from, oh, we're on the kind of the top of this thing. We're really enjoying where we're going to, nope, we're going to do something else. Like explain the experience of going through that phase.
Yeah. So when, I don't know if I've ever told this whole story, so this is a bit of an exclusive.
This is an exclusive to this podcast.
So when we started the business, I had, and Jeff had sort of very specific ideas of the kind of company that we wanted to build, the kinds of work we wanted to do. And that idea, like we were, you know, we weren't the first product design studio out there. There was like Adaptive Path and there were a few others, kind of even 37 Signals pre Basecamp were kind of like in this zone of like, we want to build really functional. We don't want to do like banner ads. We don't want to do marketing sites, nothing, no shade to those. It just wasn't like our thing. And we had this idea that like digital products, real utility was going to become really important on the internet. Right. And that proved to be accurate. Of course, you know, we couldn't have foreseen everything, but like that thesis proved to be accurate. By around 2013, I could see kind of storm clouds on the horizon. I could see the kind of clients that were coming in. I could see the move to in-house. And I said to the partners, hey, we need to figure out what the next chapter is. And I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know. Like, I can't see it clearly. Can you see anything? And we kind of had these conversations back and forth. And it was, we were kind of like, ugh, I don't know. Like, things are still going up, but I don't know how long they're going to, you know, do that for. And so in 2014, we decided to sort of just casually just sort of like throw out there, hey, maybe we'd be interested in like, you know, no reasonable offer refused kind of thing. And in early 2014, we had, I want to say four companies actually like respond positively to it. All US based big tech. So like Facebook was one of them, you know, Google's one of them. I'm not going to shame the other ones, but like there were two others in there. And we said, cool. Like, all right, so make us an offer. And all the offers we got were within $150,000 of each other.
Holy crap.
And the reason for that is in Silicon Valley, they just, all the corp dev people just like move around. They have a spreadsheet. They're like, oh, how many people do you have? This is what they're worth. Like, it's just a straight up calculation. And we were like, yeah, no. You don't seem to understand. Our business is succeeding. Like what you're offering me doesn't even like capture the upside of the business I have. This doesn't make any sense to like take this deal. They were completely flummoxed by that. They were completely, they're like, what do you mean? Like everyone takes this deal. And I'm like, yeah, no, we don't need to take this deal. And so we just, you know, we ran a process and then kind of said, this isn't the right thing for us. And then like actually recommitted to the business through, this is 2014. So we're like, all right, well, tried that. There's nothing there. We got to figure out how to make this thing work. And we were making it work. We were doing fine. We didn't know what the next chapter was, but we were good. Like we were making money and had clients. We were full up. And then around October, November of 2014, Julie Zhu, who is was a OG design leader at Facebook, reached, who we had originally contacted with in February, reached out and said, hey, like, are you like, I don't know what happened back in February, but like, would you be willing to talk again? And just by chance, I happened to be going down to San Francisco for Google had a design conference back in 2014, not I/O, it was called something else. I can't remember what it's called. I happened to be going to it. And so I was like, yeah, I'm actually going to be in the Bay Area. And so I went down to Menlo Park and that reignited conversations. It was a very different conversation at that point. And they were great. And we were able to find a deal and we did the deal right before Christmas. I think we signed it literally the night of our holiday party. And we told the team, I think a week later, unfortunately, like right at Christmas, bad timing. But then we announced it in January, kind of broadly to the industry. So it was something that was over a year in the roughly a year in the making with some fits and starts. And, you know, I also, man, I'm a big believer of like, leave the party early. like go out on top, you know, like,
yeah.
And, yeah. And so I felt like it was a good time. We had done it for 12 years, you know, and I was excited to try something different.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Good move. Good, great timing. Cause you're right. After that, there was a plateau. There was some bright stars that continued. I kind of count ourselves in that. We were like, yep. You kind of ride the wave for a little longer. But certainly by then, the buzz was off, right? You definitely needed to go home. You were like, you were the guy standing at the bar and the lights were flickering and you were like, you know, maybe I should have one more. But really, the answer was go the fuck home. Like, you need to go home now.
Yeah. And I could also just see the web kind of dying. Mm. You know, I joke that, you know,
well, not so much dying, but just becoming the same. Like everything just looked exactly the same. And nobody was willing to like, there was no way that you could say like, this is going to be cool and different, because the reality was it couldn't. It just had to work in a certain way.
And I blame, I jokingly blame who are good friends of mine, Jacob and Mark Otto, who created Bootstrap, the CSS template, which is like, once we had these templates, everything just sort of got rigid into grids, and it was like, you know, one hero, three touts, you know, and optimize the shit out of it. And that was the and then that combined with, you know, the rise of the mobile era of computing,
right,
and native and Apple just hamstringing their browser so that you had to go to native apps in the App Store. Those things kind of all come together. And I think make it really hard for those of us who are making our business in largely browser based work.
And the whole
having a conversation.
I
remember having a conversation with a prospect. They came in and they said, "We want something that looks like the Apple website." And I said, "Great, let's do that." I took a screenshot of the Apple website, and I said, first thing we're going to do is we're going to kind of white out all of their products, because those are their products; they're not your products." And then we're going to remove anything that's specifically theirs, like their logo or anything that was their brand, their identity. We're going to remove like their fonts, their logo. And eventually it's just like this blank page.
White page. Yeah. It takes two steps to get to the white page if you do that.
Yeah, and they're like, oh shit. And I was like, unless you've got some really amazing products that we can replace their amazing products.
Yeah.
There is no conversation to be had. There's no like design to be had. Yeah. This is not a, we're no longer adding any value because we're not designing anything on the page, on the web. We need to be designing the product.
Yeah.
And if we're designing the product, that's cool. Then we can have a conversation about the website.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
That reminds me of, there was also a time prior to that, like circa 2011, 2012 ish. We all probably saw these inquiries come in, like, I want to build the Facebook for this. I want to build the Facebook for that. There was like a vibe of those inbound inquiries. This is like a lesson I learned the hard way in my early biz dev days. I got a contact from somebody that said they wanted to build the Facebook for procurement professionals. They wanted to build a massive social media platform for procurement professionals. And I'm, you know, lip service on the
that
call.
That sounds so much fun.
Oh my God. So I'm like,
no, for the procurement professionals, I mean, hell for you to build it, but for the procurement professionals, I know that's what they've been asking for their whole life. So sorry.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a walled garden for them to exist within. So I'm trying to be polite about it. And then in a total rookie move, like totally burned my hand on the stove, I decide to be cute. And I tweet like, you know, when someone asks to make a social media platform, I add a zero to the price. And then the client, a day later, sent me a photo of the tweet and said, I guess we're not going to be a good fit. And I was like, I guess not. Like, I guess that's the grave I just dug for myself. So lesson learned. I'm not going to do that again. But, you know, that was There was certainly that time.
You might have actually dodged a bullet. So
I think I think it works out.
To do that. Yeah. All right. So then in the, you wind up in fucking Facebook. Like,
yeah.
And you have to like figure out Facebook. Like, how does that even happen, man? Like, how do you even like navigate Facebook at that point?
So, and at that point, this is in, I would say, the peak kind of hyperscaling, move fast, break things era. And it is just, it is chaos. in both the best possible and worst possible ways.
Okay.
And because like at the time, it's not like this anymore, but at the time there was just this insane agency given to like, if three engineers and a PM decided they wanted to do a thing, they could probably go and like build it and like ship it. Right. It was very, it was really, and so as a design lead, you're like hearing about products about to go to the door. You're like, whoa, whoa, wait. Like what is this? Or like someone would be like, hey, can I get a designer? I'm like, for what? And they would start talking about this thing. I'm like, I've never heard, like, I didn't know we were building this. I didn't know. Right. And so it was very, you know, chaotic and great. And then of course, come post-election, Cambridge Analytica, very intense, both external scrutiny and like, it doesn't feel good. Like, you know, you're trying to do good work. You're trying to do these good things. Right. And then you're like, go out in the world and you're being told you're this, you know, you're the devil and you've destroyed democracy. And it was really hard. It was really, really, really hard. Really, really difficult. But I really enjoyed the products I was working on. Like I really did believe in, you know, Facebook Marketplace. I believed in, I think, you know, one of the things that has been said, but I think is underestimated, is how important Facebook is to small business, like really small business. Like a lot of them live and die. You would go to other countries and the experience that people were having with the products we were building in Brazil or in Southeast Asia, would like, and completely not what Silicon Valley, New York, like was experiencing Facebook with. And so there was, that was super interesting to me. I found it fascinating the way that culturally people would use features and parts of the products in ways we hadn't anticipated for good and bad. Like, for example, here's an example of like for good. We worked on check-ins, you know, like the kind of GoWalla sort of era,
Foursquare,
you know, like Foursquare check-in, right? Like that was a product we had. And of course, in North America, everyone's like, check-ins, it's so lame, you know, like show, like people use it to show off, look where I am, you're not here, you know, kind of stuff, like real braggy kind of stuff. But in parts of Southeast Asia, young women were using it as a like, this is where I was last seen, or hey, come to me, I need my friends around me because I don't feel safe. Right. It was literally being used as like a safety product. Like product was never designed with that intention. I'm not sure there's any amount of research that would have uncovered that, but it was like a thing that people were using, I think, for a positive use. And of course, then on the other side, you had, you know, potential stalking concerns and there's like a whole host of stuff. So I found all of that fascinating to try to like tease through that and work through that. And so, yeah, so for 3 years I worked on those products. And then Andrew Bosworth, who we call Boz, who's now the CTO of Meta, he used to run the ads team. And then my team is sort of a subset of the, it was called Ads and Business Platform. I worked on the business platform side of it. Zuck moved him over onto ARVR. And he moved in September of 2017 and he started talking to me almost immediately. And he's like, I need some help over here. And I was like, hey man, I'm not the right person for you. I'm like, I don't know. I don't do hardware. I'm not a big gamer, which at the time Oculus and still to this day, gaming is such a core component of that. Use case of that technology. I'm like, I'm not really a gamer. It's not really my thing. Like, you probably want someone different. And he was kind of like, no, I need someone I can trust, someone I've worked with, because I have to clean this whole thing up. And I sort of, I said no, if not hard no, but like, let me think about it. I hemmed and hawed. And then in January, I decided to go and give it a shot. And I did that thing that I don't normally do, but it was like, hey, you want to be like in a room where you know the least of anyone in the room.
Mm.
Right. Like don't go to rooms where you feel you're the smartest person. Go to the room like where like you are outnumbered. And I absolutely, like when I walked in to the AR and VR teams, especially talking to our research scientist, Michael Abrash, our chief scientist, and his PhDs in the, straight up geniuses working on like optics and like how will we dissipate thermals in a glasses form factor, you know, like straight up, it's kind of like being in the 1960s at like a Xerox PARC, and there's Doug Engelbart. There's, you know, like it is akin to that. I'm not, and I don't mean to overstate it, but like working on the next generation of computing is like incredibly interesting. And so that's what I went over to go do.
Yeah.
And I had to learn. Luckily I think one thing that's not broadly recognized is the Meta industrial design team. It's led by an amazing guy named Peter Bristol. And he, I just had him, and I just had to make him look good because he was amazing. It's like, I didn't have to learn every inch of industrial design. He had an amazing team put in place. Mm. And I think that team, I would put them up against any industrial design team in the world, including Apple's. Straight up, they are amazing. And I know that because Apple keeps trying to hire them. So I love that experience. Learning how to design for spatial computing, super interesting. Everything that you and I, or like all of us, knew about design, right, comes from print. Like when we're building websites, right, we're just using print, like font type, right, color, you know, yep, color, typography, yeah, 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 grid systems, balance, proportion. It's all print stuff, right? You get into VR, its fundamental metaphor is theater, stage, props, characters, totally different metaphorical language, and architecture language comes into it as well. So I end up starting to reading, you know, rereading like a pattern language, and like reading books on like, you know, stage design and theater design for the UI components of it. Totally different. And that was, you know, absolutely fascinating. When I started at Reality Labs, which was then called ARVR, I think there were, across all of our products, I think there were 90 designers. By the time I left, it was 1,000. Now that's including user research, content, design. Now you got to remember too, when you're designing for VR and AR, you not only need a designer, you need prototypers who know Unity as well. You can't just you can't just stand it up in Figma and call it a day. And so you need just the number of people you need is much greater than 2D mobile.
Yeah, kind of like being at Pixar, you're like making film, right? Like you said, it's theater, but it's like this entire cast and crew with all of these different skill sets coming together in this singular activity. It's weird. Mm-hmm.
And the you know, the rendering engines, I got to work with John Carmack, which was an incredible honor and incredible frustration at the same time. You know, Carmack, he built the effectively the bootloader and the initial renderer for the Oculus headset. And it is like everything Carmack does, you know, so performant. Just like he writes everything in C, which so he can just be like as close to bare metal as possible. You know, it's hyper efficient. It's everything, but he doesn't give you a lot of, as a designer, a lot of ornamentation or degrees of freedom to do much inside of it, because he wants it to be super performant. And so there's always like a tension about, like, you know, designers wanted more effects and more things that's very expensive computationally in these headsets to do. Right. You know, the first, I may not have this exactly correct, I think the Quest 2 had the same processing speed as a Pixel 4 phone. I think that was it. But, you know, just not a lot of compute to play with. very tight envelopes. And so design, so I, you all remember this, remember designing for like 216 colors and like a 640, 480 screen.
Yeah.
It was like going back to that. It was like
the
constraints are insane, but you have to design inside those constraints. And as well as like, I spent a lot of time learning about input modalities, like, you know, a mouse, hands, right? Like computing have these input, these, every revolution in computing has been because of there's been a revolution in inputs, right? If you think back to mainframe computers, the punch cards, that's the input. You need a punch card. Then eventually someone's like, well, let's get a keyboard. That then, you know, made computing go up again. The PC era without the mouse, right? Like you need a new input device. Phones, touch, right? Multi-touch. So spatial needs new inputs. And so for VR, you have controllers, but you also have your hands, right? Your bare hands to use. Mm. And so we spent a lot of time working on input modalities, and that's still forming in the industry, but is something that was super interesting that I never had to worry about. I didn't have to worry about the mouse when I was building a website. Like someone figured that out years ago.
Holy crap. Well, I feel like we're at an hour and we have to be mindful of everybody's time, but
before we let John go, I've got a question. So
we did start late, we can do a few more minutes if we need to. Yeah.
I can.
Okay, so you're in this kind of like this retirement, semi-retirement, don't really know what it is. Haven't put a name to a thing. And at some point, because we all know who you are, you're not going to just be satisfied snowmobiling. So what's niggling at the back of your mind right now?
You know, nothing, which is the problem. I guess maybe the problem. I don't
know. I actually kind of like that idea.
Yeah. So there was no plan. There's no next thing. Everyone was so convinced I had like a startup or there's like another thing I was going to go do. I don't. I'm sort of waiting for inspiration to hit a little bit. I really want to get like excited about a thing again, you know, and I'm sort of having a harder time like, okay, well, what is that? Like AI, I find super interesting, but it doesn't eat at me. Like I don't, you know, stay up at night thinking about how to do that. You know, crypto stuff doesn't like, you know, I don't want to work on that. And so I'm a little bit like, okay, what's next? In the meantime, I've been like, I've had a really fun time. I have some people who I'm sort of coaching, like very design leaders. And I find that, you know, rewarding. I don't know if that's what I want to do as a full-time thing, but I have been like very selectively like doing that just to kind of keep, you know, some of the muscles going.
Yeah.
Keeping the skill sharp. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And just like, I do enjoy, like the one thing I've realized, and I think I hear this a bit in your podcast, right? Like the challenges that people, designers have and people have, they're not really new. Right, like they're things we've seen again and again, and I think that reminding, and you only sort of realize that I think with age, right? Like because you've now lived through a few cycles, you've now experienced a few things, and you start to see the patterns, you know, forming.
Yeah.
And so I found it helpful. Like I'll go talk to some people earlier in their career, and they'll come to me like, "Oh, this thing's happening," and they're really bummed out about it, or they're really stressed about it. I'm like, "Yep. Let me tell you about the 10 times like that happened to me and what we did about it." And they're like, they're so relieved that it's like, they're not alone. And so I've gotten some, you know, satisfaction doing that, but there's no like big next idea right now, Richard, to go pursue, but maybe at some point.
No, I mean, I had a similar experience. You know, I took 2 years off to kind of just advise and coach and
recover.
Honestly, like most of it was just healing and not thinking and not trying to get excited about stuff, like consciously or mindfully choosing to ignore the hype around shit and just spending a lot of time traveling and being with friends and family. And at some point, the conversations that were advisory conversations turned into other things, right? They were like, well, we're already in this conversation and we're already moving in a fun direction. Could we have more fun if we spend more time together.
Yeah.
But it was very, very organic and not in any way intentional. And I think that's what's really surprising to me is that a lot of my life was intentional up until that point. Like a lot of it was, if I do this, then this will happen. And I could make a plan and execute on the plan.
Yep.
Whereas this has been, maybe it's kind of through that lens of old age and wisdom, but it's kind of like, well, what if you didn't have a plan? What if you didn't figure it out? What if you just let all of those things come to you when they're ready? What might happen? And that was surprising. Like, just like, oh, good shit is just showing up without having to force it to happen or like have a plan for it to happen.
I do want to acknowledge that it's, you know, an incredible privilege to be able to take that time and do it. And you know, I hope for anyone listening to this or watching this, you know, I acknowledge that, like, you know, but like you, Richard, from like I said, from the time I graduated university, I went from job to job to job to job without a break, which is, you know, what vast majority of people do. So I don't pretend like that's so, you know, this isn't the stuff that folk songs are made of or anything like that, right? but I do recognize that
now that you say that you're in a wooden cabin.
I got a guitar within, maybe I'll write something after this. But I did finally have the privilege, the opportunity to take a pause in my life and not have to work, which is, like I said, an immense privilege. I'll be 52 in May. I want to be able to do a bunch of, I love doing physical things. I'm skiing. I'm actually going to Alaska on Saturday to ski. And I feel like I have a fairly small window where can do that at a level that I
responsibly
feel responsibly. Right. And I think that window is literally, I think that window was like between now and maybe 55, 56, you know, we never know how your body's going to respond or anything like that. And I did my best to take care of myself. Last year, I was diagnosed with cancer, and it's all taken care of. But that was a real, I left work in April, and in July I was in surgery for colon cancer. So, public service message, if you're over the age of 45, go get a colonoscopy. It was early detection that got me, and I was able to deal with it surgically. But that also put a real fine point of like, hey, tomorrow's not promised. You know, like time, how do you want to spend your time? Where do you want to put your energy? And so, you know, Richard, just to sort of end your point, I probably won't go snowmobiling forever, but like right now, that is kind of like how I want to spend some of my time, because there's going to be maybe in the near future a time where I can't do those things and I can go do other things, right? So
It's a loaded question for me because, you know, you probably know, like my wife died of cancer two years ago. And the loaded question is very often people will say, well, I'm working on a new startup, or like, I'm going to work again. I'm going to do this thing. And really what we're interested in hearing is maybe not, maybe something else. Maybe that isn't the answer. Maybe you write a book, maybe you write poetry, maybe you write folk songs, whatever it is, it doesn't have to be fitting in with this constant, you know, capitalist story, which is like we go from thing to thing to thing and then we retire and we die later. Like it doesn't have to be like that. It could be something completely different.
Yeah. That's, and I want to add to that too. I think, John, you're being thoughtful about your current circumstances and how you're experiencing a very specific version of having time to figure things out. But I think generally that doesn't mean you can't exhibit the same behaviors while working full time if you don't have the luxury of having, or the opportunity or the privilege to have, time off. Like part of it is just listening and realize, we've talked about this before, like this sensation that the buttons on your shirt are pulling you towards something. Like you kind of have to just open yourself up to that possibility and listen for that. And sometimes those things will emerge, but you have to like be mindful of that. You have to kind of just be committed to kind of giving yourself space to kind of recognize that. And you can do that when you're working full time. You don't have to be, you know, in this space where you have a blank canvas. You just have to be open to being thoughtful and intentional and listening for those kinds of pulls. And then what's that? Like, what is, why am I being pulled in this direction? Let me investigate this further. I think as you gain experience over time, that ability gets a little bit better and you start to like understand yourself a little bit better. And I think you can do all of what you're describing in a way, even if you are in a 9-to-5, even if you are still, you know, working on something, it's just, you know, give that stuff a chance is the mantra.
Yeah. And I think it's very easy to kind of go into autopilot. I also see younger people earlier in their career falling into the trap of like, and, you know, mimicking of what they think success is by like, they model based on what's around them without really saying like, hey, will that make me happy? Now, sometimes you don't know if it'll make you happy until you like go do it and then go, yeah, actually this isn't for me. But I do think that taking a minute and saying, just because that person is doing that doesn't mean that you have to do it. Just because the sort of world says you go from this to this, this to this is the way to do it. And so I do agree with you, Joe. I think having that intentionality, just taking a beat, thinking about it, moving it from the back of your head to the front of your head, not getting into autopilot is good. You know, and I think that, you know, I think that for me, it's coming up on a year, although with the health thing I mentioned, it kind of like bisected it. So it hasn't been, I sort of like retired, then had to deal with this thing, and then finally like got back into like chilling somewhere around October. So it still feels pretty new, to me. Like I haven't kind of written it out. And, you know, quite frankly, I don't know, Richard, if you found this, I'm shocked at how the days fill up. Like I look up
I'm 100% busier than I was, but I'm busy in a way that's so much more acceptable to my body and my mind and my soul. Like it's not busy because somebody else put a fucking meeting on my calendar, or I got told I have to fly to another city for a meeting that I don't really want to be at, or any other version of that. It's busy because I am going out and intentionally spending time with people that I love in the places and environments and experiences that I want to be. And I'm front loading it. I'm doing it at a reasonable pace, but I think it's probably the busyness is mostly because I feel an urgency. I feel like, shit, my wife was 39 years old when she died. Mm-hmm. My best friend's wife was 37 when she died. Mm. My neighbor's, who is my son's best friend's father, died when he was 39. And it's like, there is no guarantee that tomorrow is going to come around. Like it might sound morbid to people who are listening to this. It's the opposite of morbid. It's the exact opposite of morbid. It's like live right now and live with the fierceness that you can, because you will literally drive out your driveway and it may be the last time you see your family. It's just, that's the way it is. Yep. It's just shit happens like that.
Well, let's talk about websites.
Oh my God. So good.
I agree with everything. I think I just needed to, I don't want to end on such a intense.
No, John, we like to go watch the firm. We like to end our conversations on a
It's textbook broadcasting. Textbook broadcasting is just to like great. End on like a real, real heavy note.
Let's talk about
it. Oh,
shit.
It's like a 6-minute episode. So, we'll see you next week.
That's right.
Yeah, like I'm like, will we? I don't know. Stop. Like unsubscribe.
Thank you so much, John. It was wonderful to see you. We have to catch up more either here or IRL or something because it's been too long. But
yes,
really appreciate your time, man.
I would love to. Love to see you all in person. I will try to get to the East Coast and down to Philly, New York. Are you still in Boston, Richard? Are you still in Boston? No.
Well, Joe, Boston for Richard.
Joe's threatening to put together an event, so we may just like meet somewhere in the middle of the world where everybody can fly to, and it'll I don't know. Maybe there's some skiing to be done as well, something like that.
Ooh. Well, let me know. Denver is kind of in the middle, so whatever.
There you go.
That'd be great. Anyway, it was great to chat with y'all. This has been awesome.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Bye.